When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Marty Fish, nothing personal, word of the day. We've got to sit down. He's here. The Marty Fish, the famous Marty Fish, on and off the court, has graced us with his presence for 45 minutes here on a Sampson sit down. We have so much to get to. Let me first start by saying, welcome to Nothing Personal, Marty. How are you?
Thank you. Yeah, big fan. Big fan of yours. I've been listening to the Levitard show for quite a while now. Loved your sit downs with them all the way through. When you couldn't talk, when you weren't allowed to say anything, all the way up until you literally say anything. So thanks for having me, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've been freed now. Once I was out of baseball, it's like I've been unshackled and I'm able to talk about anything. But one of the shows that we did here that got the most attention, I would say, was a show when I was very honest, and nothing personal. I'm honest about everything. Just it's a no holds barred about the world of sports and culture and entertainment, but also about me personally. And I was discussing my anxiety issues. And the first anxiety attack I ever had was on the team plane in 2003, flying to San Francisco for the first round of the playoffs. And I didn't know what was going on, except I said to the trainer on the plane, "We have to land because I'm about to die." And I had a full plane of players. We were flying out to the playoffs. We were in the middle of a 6-hour flight from Florida. And he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "No, you don't realize I'm not crying wolf here. I'm about to die. And I don't want to die on this Miami Air charter. So we're going to have to land." And he calmed me down somehow. All I remember is I was at a doctor in San Francisco before my first ever playoff game. I went to a psychologist in San Francisco that I got through the Giants. And that was my first experience with panic attacks. And they've continued, unfortunately, ever since, including the day of this taping. I had a terrible one that I'm just almost in the middle of right now. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you this is you are the star of your own documentary that I want to talk about, where you were unbelievably open about the anxiety issues that you have. What made you, Marty, decide that you were prepared to let people in on your life in that way?
Yeah. I'm sorry you're dealing with that. I'm sorry you had to deal with that. Maybe this will help. We start talking about it, talking about things. You know, what's funny is leading into that question. First and foremost, it helped me to talk about it. It really did. It helped me. I felt better when I was open, when I was fairly vulnerable, although I didn't really feel like I was being vulnerable, because again, it helped me. And I felt better when I talked about it. Secondly, and maybe just as important, I don't know, maybe you can tell me this just as important. I wanted to be a success story. I wanted to be someone that people can lean on and know the story, understand what I've gone through, and say there's someone who was sort of, the life was sort of taken away from them, their work or job was taken away from them a bit, and not only did they get it back, but they succeeded in getting it back. They jumped back into the fire, if you will, and was able to thrive again, professionally, and personally. And I didn't have that. I'm a huge sports fan. I've been a huge sports fan my whole life, born in Minnesota. And grew up in Florida. So Minnesota roots all the way through: Twins, Vikings, Timberwolves, Gophers, the whole thing. I didn't go to college. My dad went to University of Minnesota. So I'm a Gophers fan. There you have it. It's brutal to be a Minnesota sports fan nowadays, but here we are. I wanted to, I, you know, and again, I was a big sports fan and I didn't have that like you know, that athlete or that, I don't know, celebrity is the right word, that athlete to like sort of, sort of go, okay, there's someone that, that struggled with mental health that, was able to beat it and, you know, have success afterward. There had been a couple instances that I can remember where there was a golfer that, in Orlando one time that struggled on the golf course in the third round of a tournament. I forget his name. He actually had to like lay down on the course at one point, actually ended up winning the golf tournament. There was, I don't know if you remember Royce White, I believe his name, who was a basketball player for Iowa State. He was a really good basketball player, got drafted by the Bulls. He couldn't like fly and he couldn't be a professional NBA professional basketball player because of his anxieties but he never really came out with it. And so like, there wasn't really a success story, really something to go, there's someone that I know of that I've heard of and beat it, you know, and like, and had some struggles and came back. And so I wanted to be that person. I wanted to lean on, I wanted people to be able to lean on my success story of, cause it is a success story in terms of mental health. To say there's someone who was successful with it.
But I feel like you're starting at the end a little bit and I want to get inside Untold and Breaking Points is the show. If you haven't seen the documentary about Marty and his journey, you have to watch it immediately right after this show. Please watch it. But I feel like I don't want to let you off the hook a little bit because you're starting at the end. How did you know you'd be a success story when you're in the middle of realizing that you can't perform at your job because of the anxiety issues? I think the whole problem is you can't see the end at that point. And so that seems to be a tremendous amount of pressure that you're putting on yourself while you're still going through it. Or once you solve the issue, did you then say that's what I wanted was to be the success story?
It was after, for sure. I mean, during, you know, I mean, I didn't have a history of mental health, didn't have anyone around me, very close to me that had issues with mental health. So I didn't know what was going on. I certainly initially didn't know what was going on throughout the summer of 2012, which was when it really came to a head. I didn't understand what these thoughts were, what panic attacks were, what anxiety attacks were. I knew I was having anxious moments, figured they'd go away, figured that, you know, I wasn't having them on the tennis court in 2012. It was really the only place that I wasn't. And so I just felt like, you know, well, if I don't have them on the tennis court, then I'm sure eventually they'll just go away. And boy, was I wrong. So having to pull out of the US Open, that year, 2012, it allowed me to get help, allowed me to get on the right track. But I wasn't ready to tell everyone about it, nor did I even know what was going on. Was I going to be able to play in Asia in October? And this was, you know, late August, early September. Was I going to be able to play in November in Europe? I have no idea. So all those things were sort of happening, you know, just sort of in real time. And so it wasn't until probably when I realized that I knew that the end of my career was near, that I knew the next chapter in my life was hopefully going to start, that I really wanted to come out with it and really talk about it, openly talk about it. And the first time that I did that was in the Players Tribune. We wrote a piece, myself and a ghostwriter wrote a piece in the Players Tribune, which I love, just about my struggles and about, I see that smirk. I do love the Players Tribune, the avenue that it gives to athletes and professional athletes and things.
We can still be friends. We can still be friends, Marty. I promise.
No matter who started it, it's fine. So that was where we started. We started there. 2015 was my last tournament, the US Open there. Wanted to get back there, wanted to get back to that, that place where it was sort of all taken away from me. And that was, you know, for me, it wasn't about winning the tournament. I knew I wasn't gonna win that tournament. It wasn't even about winning matches. It was just about stepping back on the court, and getting into the fire of a really uncomfortable place. And the last time that I had been on the court was the worst moments of my, maybe worst moments of my life. So, so that's why we came out with it and when we came out with it.
So let's go back to 2012. You're in the US Open. You're playing in Arthur Ashe Stadium. I think it may have been called that back in 2012. It's the main stadium at the US Open, the biggest tournament for professional tennis in the United States. Some would argue the world, though. Some may say it's Wimbledon, but let's just say it's the US Open for now. And, you know, you're playing a solo sport. When I had mine, I had people around me who I could talk to. The thought of playing a solo sport the way you do and being alone on a court and having that issue when you can't, it's not like there's coaching. We know it's against the rules to be coached during a match. You have maybe a line judge back then, some ball people, but being alone like that, or even in the locker room, what was the trigger when you said, I'm using that word double entendre, not the trigger for the attack. When you said, that's it, I cannot play today. Do you remember that thought process?
I do. Look, I mean, so I came to that in I was in the fourth round of the US Open that year. In the third round was sort of the first time that the panic and anxiety attacks hit me on the tennis court. I was always free. And that was the only place of comfort for me in my mind. On the tennis court, on the practice court, whatever it was, I had a lot of things to worry about, think about. So I stepped out there in that third round match against Gilles Simon, a French, tough French guy. And we had an up and down match, a really stressful, anxiety filled match, right? Like, you know, lots of breaks and holds and breaks and more breaks and breaks a serve. And so it was a really roller coaster type match. So I can, looking back now, I can sort of understand why I was stressed during that match. I mean, it was a roller coaster of a match. You're playing and you're right. For an American, the US Open is the biggest tournament of the year. There's no question. It's the one we want to win most. I think the consensus for most Americans is. That's where the most hustle and bustle and stress is of our year, you know, so that tournament. It wasn't until sort of the morning that I was supposed to play Federer. It was Labor Day, Arthur Ashe Stadium. You're right. It was the, one of the biggest matches you can play. It was sort of the culmination of all the hard work and dedication, professionalism, and you know all the adjectives you can use to describe the what I had gone through and what I had sacrificed to get there, only to not play. And that thought process never would have crossed my mind. It wasn't ingrained in me. It's not ingrained in athletes. I don't think it's ingrained in very many people. Specifically tennis players. You're right. Tennis is a really individualistic sport. It's the only major sport. Think marathon runner or something like that, but like you leave the locker room, we're all by ourselves. So we got to figure out how to beat one person that day all by ourselves. We don't have to beat the whole draw. You don't have to beat 25 people, just one person that one day, but you get no help. You got to do it on your own. So the thought of having to go out there by myself, when I was feeling like this was daunting to say the least. I was emotional. I'm not a crier, but I was crying like crazy in the car headed to the site that day. I'm a really big proponent of a support system. I had a phenomenal support system that started with my wife, and my wife didn't grow up in sports. She didn't, you know, play very many sports. If she says she played high school tennis, but I'm yet to see where the talent is there. But phenomenal wife, phenomenal mother. Not a great tennis player, but she sort of put in my mind and in my head. Well, you don't actually have to play. And I never, I never would have thought that. I was never trained that. I was trained to never show weakness, never show fear, never, you know, try not to show emotion, try not to show negative emotion. That was hard at times, the negative emotion part, but it was, but that's how I was trained. So thank God she was there to put that thought in my head, because I don't think I ever would have done that.
Was she in the car with you on the way? Because my guess is that you could have been staying back then at the Hyatt, which is the hotel on 42nd and Lex, and you have to go over the Midtown Tunnel to get to the where Citi Field is, where Shea Stadium was at that point, or maybe Citi was open. Are you in the car with your wife when you're crying, or are you just with the driver?
Yeah, I'm with my trainer, my wife, and my coach and the driver. So you know, not alone either. And so again, great support system, and my physio is still to this day one of the closest people I have, partly because of going through that process with him and them as well.
Ask you what's wrong, Marty, when you're doing that, when you're on your way to play Roger Federer in the fourth round of the US Open in the main stadium on the big stage, and you start breaking down on the way? Are they wondering whether this is nerves, or are you able to explain to them what's happening or not?
Yeah, at this point, I'm at this point, they fully know what's going on. Certainly my wife did, although she hadn't dealt with any mental health issues in her past. She was very she's a Jewish mother, if you know what that means, right? So she overbearing, loving, loves family, loves family, friends, that type of thing. And so she was very very understanding. But maybe that's not the best word. Maybe she was very open to understanding what was going on, or trying to understand what was going on, because she hadn't dealt with something like that. But with me explaining to her what was going on, she's explaining to me that, you know, other sides of the coin, which are, you know, this may be your job, and you may want to go out there and play, but you're not forced to go out there and play. You don't have to play another match for the rest of your life if you don't want to. That thought process never, ever would have crossed my mind. I would have somehow tried to, this is not the way I'm wired. It's just not, I would have tried to play. I don't know how, what I would have done. Same thing with you on the airplane. You know, I would have gotten on the airplane, but I wouldn't have known how to say, hey, I got to get off right now. I would have just sort of tried to fight through it somehow.
But it didn't. So it didn't occur to you to turn the car around. So we're still not at that point yet. You get into the locker room. I want to get right to, there had to have been the inflection point, right? Where you were a walkover, and you had to come to grips with that fact. And that's an important part of the movie, in that it marks such an unbelievable moment in your life that begins the journey to the success that you talked about. But where was that inflection point? In the locker room? Because it wasn't in the car, or else you would have turned the damn thing around.
It was in the car, but the reason why we didn't turn it around is because you got to go and actually pull out of the event. Have to go and tell the referees and tournament directors and tournament director of the US Open, who wants that match to be played, the American number one against the number one in the world, is a big match for that tournament. So they care. ESPN, I think at the time it was CBS was still doing the weekends there at the US Open. It was Dick Enberg, and John McEnroe, that call, you know, that you love, that I loved back in the day, those guys calling the Labor Day and weekend final of the US Open. And so you've got to go and tell them. You're supposed to go and actually talk to the media as well, which I didn't do, thankfully, because I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what was... what to say. You know, I mean, sorry, I can't play. I'm not ready to necessarily tell you why. I'm not comfortable enough to tell you why, or vulnerable enough at the moment, but I can't do that right now.
Did you have PR help? back, and we're saying back in the day, by the way, that was 2012. Yeah. It's only nine years ago. Were there PR people there who were imploring you to please meet with the media the way they did with Osaka and everybody else in today's tennis world?
There are ATP media that ask. I think they probably, looking back, they probably saw my face and just went like, something's wrong here. I think I said something to the effect of, and again, I don't remember vividly because, you know, as tennis players, we remember, I mean, it's our job. So we remember points and matches very vividly. I don't remember. I think I pulled out with like a knee injury, quote unquote, because you had to pull out of something with something. I couldn't say mental health, certainly back then. It would have been like, what are you talking about? What is mental health? And what are you talking about? You're going out there in an hour, right? Like, and so, so, you know, you come, yeah. So that's why I didn't turn the car around. Because I had to go. We then jumped in a car right away, went back to the hotel, tried to get on a plane. Cause all I wanted to do was get home. All I wanted to do was start the process of healing somehow. I wanted to get on medication if that's what it took. I wanted to see a doctor if that's what it took. I was desperate for help.
Your agent understand, Marty?
Probably not. I mean, no, I mean, you know, but my agent, again, like a support system, like, right. Like, and my agent and I, he's been my agent for over 20 years. He's a friend. He's not an agent, you know, like to me. So he would, you know, he would have gone, wow, that's an interesting thing to do, but I got your back, you know, and if anybody asks, I'll, you know, I got your back kind of thing. I don't even think I told him at the time what was going on. So he, you know, he didn't even know. And a lot of people, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people close to me have watched this thing. I got some, you know, some of my best friends in the world are like, man, I didn't realize that, you know, after watching the documentary, I didn't realize that it was that bad or that you were that deep in it, or I wish I would have known or done something or anything. And I tell them all, like, you wouldn't have known. I mean, I wasn't ready to, ready to be open or vulnerable to everyone then, although it did make me feel better when I talked about it. And so the more and more I opened up about that, part of my life, the better I felt. So, you know, over time, over months, I would open up a little bit to Andy Roddick. I would open up a little bit to James Blake. Those, you know, it's two of my best friends on the tour. Why aren't you playing? Well, here's why I'm not playing, and sort of be fairly vague with it, but still letting them know what was going on.
You mentioned Andy Roddick. He's a big part of the documentary on Netflix called Breaking Point. And what is interesting is the relationship you had with him started as what I would call boys and grew into men and unbelievable competitors. For people who don't realize, they were rivals, sort of like Magic and Bird, is what Marty and Andy were. And it manifested itself on the court, but they were incredibly close, that you learned during this documentary, off the court, including the fact that you moved in with his family, which creates sort of a brother competition. And still, Andy had no idea what was going on during this.
He didn't. And you know, what's funny with Andy is that he was retiring that year. So he actually told me at the US Open that year, he said, this is my last tournament. And like, that was a huge thing for me as well, because, and an emotional thing too, because we had come up together. We played our first match when we were 11 years old against each other in San Lando, Florida, and north of Orlando. And so I'm like, shithole town in the middle of nowhere. Can we cuss on this? Sorry. Some bleep hole town in the middle of nowhere. We played our first match there. So we had a ton of history, clearly. My relationship with Andy was more of like brothers still, you know, like he asked me the other day if I wanted to go to a golf trip with him. And I'm like, I don't really want to go to a golf trip. And we got in an argument because like, I didn't want to go on a golf trip. And he's like, why don't you want to go on a golf trip with me? You know? So like, we fought about everything, but we were brothers. We were like family. There's nothing that can be said between us that would change that ever. We've gotten into it on the court 10, 15 times, probably, almost every match we've ever played. Probably even when we were playing doubles together, to be honest. So, and that's rare. So I want to serve first. No, I want to serve first kind of thing, to start the match. So we have a different, relationship for sure. He understands me, and my lifestyle and what we've been through, maybe more than anyone, and still someone that, you know, that I'm clearly very close with to this day.
I want to read to you. Coca just found the exact release that was given by your agent, John Tobias, that day. And I want to read you what he said. And then I'd like you to answer this question, given where we are in 2021. And I'd like you to rewrite it for us, given the state of the world and the state of mental health and how much more open we can be about mental health issues. This is what he said back then. When asked what happened, we are not 100% sure what the issue is and if it is related to his previous issues. Marty is fine and will return home to LA tomorrow. This was strictly precautionary, and I anticipate that Marty will play in Asia this fall.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay. That's a great find. First of all,
that's Coca, the number one producer.
Number one, needs to deal with his closet issue, but yeah, other than that, he's a great producer.
He is not in the closet. He's completely out in every way.
Okay. I
know. tell me about this and how you would write it today.
So I'm assuming that he's thinking about, you know, cause I had a look the, in a really short way, I'll try to explain how this thing started. And I had a heart issue called tachycardia. It's an electrical issue around your heart. There's electrodes around your heart. It's the quarterback to your heart. When it fires, it tells your heart to beat. Fire up, 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 fire up, up, up. There's thousands of them. They can fire uncontrollably sometimes. They can malfunction. When they malfunction, they fire uncontrollably. They can fire. Your heart doesn't know anything else but to beat. Bum, 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 bum. I trained at a really high level off the court and in practice with a heart rate monitor. I tried to get my heart to a certain number as high as I could possibly get it. And then in 25 seconds, I would try to get it down as low as I possibly could. That's how I trained. So I knew that whatever I did on the court or off the court fitness wise, I couldn't get my heart past 192 beats per minute. That's as high as I ever saw it go. When I had this tachycardia issue, my heart would beat 220, 230 beats per minute. So I'm thinking when this is initially happening, holy bleep, I'm dying. Is my heart going to explode? I don't know anything. I don't know what's going on. So I had to go to the hospital a few times because of that. Looking back, it's similar to a panic attack or something like that. I got that fixed, but from the traumatic experiences of that, you know, where my heart's beat, I don't want to go back. Am I going to go back to that? So I think I developed a lot of the, you know, apart from the stress of just, you know, everyday life and jobs and that everybody has, I did have that issue. So I think that press release sounds like it's not related to, or it may be directly or not related to that incident. So I'll rewrite it. Marty has severe anxiety disorder. He has tried to deal with this for the entire summer, has played through it. And is now hit a place where he doesn't feel comfortable on the court. And he's going to see a full range of doctors and do a lot of testing in Los Angeles starting tomorrow. And we will update you further on when he's going to play. That would be the new today. I would be comfortable today putting that type of release out.
Would you have approved that release in 2012?
Probably not.
interesting, right? I've been thinking so much about this, and there's so much criticism that athletes get specifically because we want our athletes to perform. We want them to show up, right, and do their job and win. And we want to cheer for them and then be proud that they've done something that we can't do, that we wish we could do, that other people can do and get rich doing it. That's, don't tell me you have a bad knee. Don't tell me you have a bad heart. Don't tell me you're fighting with your wife. Don't tell me you're anxious. Just go play. Right? That's the general mentality that you're up against and that is pervasive in every clubhouse and locker room in the country where professional athletes live. But now it seems like what Naomi did, what Simone did, I'm sure you were watching with great interest what happened with Simone in the Olympics and how she just had the twisties, as she calls it, which is, I guess, like the yips, but more dangerous in baseball. I don't know what the equivalent would be in tennis. What's the equivalent to the yips in tennis?
Maybe just a not being able to make a set, double faulting 25 times a match. That would be the yips.
Have you seen that?
Yes, I have, male and female, great players and terrible players alike. Thank God I've never had it, never had to deal with it, but it is real.
So the yips happened. Simone drops out of a few events, comes back, but then just said that she should have not actually competed at all in Tokyo. Yeah. And you know, Naomi Osaka is not playing at all. She's now saying, I don't know when I'll play again. And I'm just wondering, you are the pioneer almost. And for when people watch this documentary, as I really think about this, you may be the first athlete who was willing to truly discuss this in the detail you did in the movie. Do you realize sort of when you say you want it to be a success, but the import of what you're doing, are you now sort of the spokesperson for anxiety disorder for professional athletes? Is that a role you want?
Yeah. I mean, I would love a role where I can tell my story that helps people, that helps others. This doc has come out and I don't have hundreds of direct messages on Twitter. I have thousands, David, thousands, not hundreds. I mean, I can send you the video where you can video your phone and I just sort of go through. I've written to everyone back. It's taken some time. Every day I look and I've got, you know, 20 or 30 more. And that makes me feel good. It makes me feel like, you know, I started this whole thing and Netflix and Players Tribune and the Way brothers come and they say, you know, we want to do this and we've chosen yours and, you know, okay, I'm ready. And I say, okay, I'm ready. Yep.
They're the directors. Just want to let people know the Way, in case people don't, the Way brothers directed Breaking Point. Sorry.
Phenomenal directors. Sort of a perfect storm, if you will. I love what the Players Tribune does. Netflix, obviously a monster platform. And then the Way brothers are just phenomenal. If you haven't seen anything that they've done, check out Wild Wild Country, Battered Bastards of Baseball. They've won multiple Emmys, phenomenal directors and writers. They have a history of tennis as well. They grew up around tennis, so they understood it a little bit. They're fans of tennis. Perfect storm in terms of how to get this story out. Do I want to be the first one? No, I don't want to be the first one. But somebody's got to do it. Look, you mentioned Naomi. Naomi and I are very close. She lives out here in Los Angeles. We play tennis together. I know her agent very well. And again, it's, you know, you say agent, you just think, people think like, oh, it's just your agent. Nowadays, agents are really like integral in athletes, especially individual athletes' lives. And hers is no different. So she relies on him, Stuart Duguid, very much. Stuart and I are very close as well. Naomi, Simone, I mean, Naomi's a person that really understands her place in history. She wants to be one of the greatest tennis players ever. So for her, you know, for me understanding that and sort of following along at the French Open, she had won the two previous Grand Slams. She had won the US Open and the Australian Open earlier that year. She pulls out of the French Open in the third round. I know that she understands history of tennis. I understand that she wants to be one of the greatest ever, wants to win, you know, as many Grand Slams, as more Grand Slams than anyone. So I see that and I say, man, she pulled out. Like, that's not just a I don't want to talk to the media type pullout. Simone Biles has worked at least the last 5 years for the Olympics, and obviously her entire life, to get to the position that she's in. And just to not want to step out there, not be able to step out there, really shows me that she's struggling with something. Yes. I think it's more than, you know, they call it the twisties or the yips. I would assume it's probably a little more than that, but again, if that's all it is, she's a human being. And like, you know, I don't know anything about gymnastics per se. So like, you know, you get the twisties and you'd hurt, really hurt yourself really bad. So maybe it takes or took a male to come out and say, hey, you know, I struggled with this. Maybe people, you know, cause a lot of the dialogue back and forth after that, even to me, who understands mental health really well, was half negative, half positive, which was a bummer. And everyone that reached out to me and said, oh, that's pretty, you know, she didn't want to play and she's not very good on clay, so she just didn't want to play the French Open. So naive, so naive. And I would try and, you know, try and explain to them my thoughts behind it without judgment, just saying, look, this is what I think. And I lived through this type of thing. Maybe it took a female's touch in my wife to tell me it's okay to not compete today or to not play today. And maybe it takes a male's touch to go, hey, mental health is real. And I struggled with this, and I'm not, you know, like, look, I don't play a contact sport or didn't play a contact sport. I'm not a football player or a boxer or anything. I practice mixed martial arts. I do kickboxing and Muay Thai. It's what I practice and train. I spar all the time. I'll fight anyone. So it's not about like, you know, I'll spar with anyone. So like, it's not about being tough. It's not about that at all. It's about showing tens of millions of Americans that deal with mental illness or mental health every day, that you're not alone and it's okay. It's okay to not be okay. I wanted people to understand that from my perspective. I wanted people to understand that, you know, this is a male from a man's game, you know, I guess. And like, I played tennis on the male side. And so like, you know, I don't know if that had anything to do with it, where people, you know, people, their reaction to Simone and Naomi, hopefully it isn't, but I feel like probably there's a little bit of that sort of female aspect to it.
I have a mea culpa, which is that when she pulled out of the French Open, because we are in 2021, I had an expectation that if there is something going on, say it. You can say it through a PR person. You can say it through yourself. And it was on the heels of the issue of not wanting to meet the media. And the mea culpa is on a Nothing Personal episode. I took her to task. I said, that's your job. You know, players don't like meeting the media. I don't like meeting the media, but it was part of my job for 18 years. And that's just the rules of engagement. If you want to get paid to be the president of a team or to make $50 million in endorsements, you've got to meet the media. I would not have said any of those things had the explanation simply been, it's not that I don't want to meet the media. I can't meet the media. It's not that I don't want to do my job. I cannot walk on the court right now and do my job. I think the messaging, given that we're in 2021, if she had called you, I'm wondering whether you would have advised her, listen, it's okay to be outward about this and not make it about you and the media.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly would have said that. I certainly would have at least said, be vulnerable with someone, be vulnerable with your agent, Stuart, be vulnerable with me, anyone that you are close with. I don't know the inner workings of Simone Biles, you know, personal life. Obviously she's gone through a lot. We know that, you know, and I don't know, you know, Naomi, I don't know her, you know, personal life with her family or her parents or her boyfriend. You know, she's a real human. And so these things, are uncomfortable. She's shy. That doesn't mean just because you're shy doesn't mean you don't need to talk to the media. That doesn't mean that. What people don't understand too, with someone like her, someone like Roger Federer, Rafa does it a little bit better where Nadal does it a little bit better where he acts like he doesn't speak quite as good of English as he actually does. I'm sure you've been seen a few baseball players like that. Naomi and like Federer, you know, Roger speaks like five different languages. He's got to do press in five different languages as long as I did in English, every language. And so like Naomi speaks obviously fluent Japanese, and the Japanese media is all over the place and all over her all the time. So she's got to do, let's call it an hour and 15 minutes of American or English media and another hour and 15. That's a lot. It's a ton. And so she was trying to consolidate it somehow and figure out a way where somehow we can we figure out a way where this is more comfortable for everyone? Can we sit down and get in a room and feel like, you know, what do you guys want out of me? What can I get out of, what can I get out of you guys?
That's different than blanketly saying, I'm not going to meet the media, right? What you're saying is you want to change a rule, and I'm all okay with that. And that's what I said on the show, which is if you want to change how the media interacts with tennis players before matches, after matches, but I don't think you can just say, hey, I don't want to do that now. And that's why I wish maybe she would have gone into detail and said, it's not that I'm uncomfortable or not that I don't want to give the Japanese media time. I watched Ichiro negotiate with the Japanese media, the American media, and it's brutal. He also said that he did not speak English, but he did speak perfect English, by the way. Yeah. And one of the factors that occurs to me is that she's so young, right? She, you know, you talk about her that wanting to be the world's greatest tennis player and wanting to have the most grand slams. She's 23 years old, right?
Yep.
So she's not equipped to maybe deal with, and I worry about this as a former team president. We do so much to these young people and we treat them as adults. We make them, we pay them like adults. We make them act like adults. And we never want to believe that they can act like a person who's 23 or 22 or 21. And I think that's the biggest issue in sports right now is what we're demanding of these young people. And we're watching these athletes burn out at a rate that is really unheard of. And tennis to me is a prime example. Because you were ahead of the game in tennis. There have been young players burning out in tennis for 40 years. But I feel like the stakes are so much higher now with social media and how that has really changed all of us. Do you see in your conversations with players that they're getting burnt out earlier, faster? And do you think social media is a part of it? Anxiety is a part of it? Expectation? What are you seeing in today's players?
Yeah, I mean, look, social media can be a great outlet, which it is for me right now. I haven't had one person in those thousands of people write direct messages to me, say, hey, why'd you come out with that? You're soft. You're, you know, X, Y, and Z. Not one. Okay. So for me right now, Twitter, which usually is a pretty nasty place, is actually an awesome place right now. Now that is not the case for everyone. And a lot of these athletes can't not look at their mentions. They can't not look when you lose matches. I did it. And I was, you know, 32 years old when I did it. I joined Twitter in 2011. Andy Roddick told me to join and he's on it and he's right. You know, he's on there in the mornings and he's writing good morning. I'm like, what are you doing? Like writing good morning. Like what is this stupid thing? You know? And you know, that was 2011. So like, that was 10 years ago and he told me to get on and I eventually got on. And when we were in a tournament in Rome and like the, you know, and I looked every time after every match at like my mentions and who bet against me and who bet for me, you know, all that stuff. And like, it's a nasty place. It's nasty. And so that's a whole different conversation of like, how can social media help, young people, not just athletes, like just young high school kids, college kids, young adults, young professionals. Succeed.
You could frame it the other way. How is social media hurting all of these young people, all of the Twitter shaming and cyber bullying? It is a huge, huge issue. I don't want to keep you much longer, but I have to ask before we promote the movie one more time, make sure you watch Untold Breaking Point on Netflix. Davis Cup. You're the captain. The Davis Cup team captain, like that's even cooler than being number one in the world in my mind, although you probably wouldn't agree with that. But being the captain, tell me, give me an update. What's going to happen? Because you're traveling to a Davis Cup round, aren't you?
It's a dream job of mine. It's an absolute dream to be to represent your country. There's something about walking around with the red, white, and blue flag on your sleeve, on your chest. So it's a total dream job. I've been enamored by the captaincy even while I was playing. I loved the idea of being able to pick the team and the surface and where we play and all of it, all good and bad. I love it all. We play in a sort of new revamped Davis Cup. Now they're trying to sort of turn it into the World Cup of tennis, really, if you will. It's like a soccer, you know, sort of World Cup. There's three cities, six groups of three, two groups in each city. We play Italy and Colombia, late November in Turin, Italy. Which will be awesome. I mean, we play, in Italy, on their surface, they have an unbelievable team. We've got a great team. We've got great players. We've got young guys, old guys. And I get to pick from 12, you know, or 14 great players into five. And I love every aspect of it. I love picking the team. I love telling them that, you know, like that they're not on the team, that they're on the team. It sounds kind of weird, but I love it. It's a huge honor. And something that I will always keep near.
You know, Marty, that makes you a GM, by the way. Everything you just described.
Yeah.
You're responsible.
I love it. I play fantasy sports. I'm a GM of my fantasy teams. and I love it. I really do. It's just a huge honor. It's a huge honor to play Davis Cup. There's only four or five spots. There were four spots when I played. You know, the Ryder Cup in golf is 12 spots. So it's obviously really difficult to even make the team. I made the team a lot. I'm the captain of the Davis Cup. It's the greatest job you could possibly imagine. And I love it.
Well, I couldn't be happier for you. I could keep going because I'd want to talk about social media. I'd want to talk more. I have so many things I didn't get to. But Marty, I do appreciate your time. Again, please, you can follow him on Twitter, obviously, because he's a funny follow and a good follow.
You can write me on Twitter. You can write me too.
I feel like I'm cool.
You don't write me on Twitter. Other people, anyone can write me. I'll write you back. I promise.
Your DMs are open, as are mine, but you and I get to text. I'm thankful for our friendship. And I want to say that if you have not watched Breaking Point on Netflix, please do it and recognize how brave and courageous Marty Fish was. Not just as a player, as a father, as a man, as a husband, but as someone willing to share his story and share his pain in order to make other people better. Marty, on behalf of all of us, thank you for having done that. And I really appreciate you taking the time today.
It's really nice of you to say, David. I appreciate it. I appreciate our friendship too, man. And I hope to see you in person one time. And let's do this again. Let's do it again soon.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.